Amen. Well, we're going to be in the book of Exodus. Book of Exodus this morning. Should be easy to find. Genesis, Exodus, starting into a journey here that we've called Route 66. We talked a little bit about that iconic American road that led from Chicago to Santa Monica Pier on the Pacific Coast, nearly 3,000 miles, a grand journey through the heartland of America, often called Main Street of America. And we're taking an equally ambitious journey and a much more significant journey through the Scriptures to understand God's overarching redemptive plan. So here's those 66 books. We've been giving particular attention, obviously, here at the outset to the first five, the orange stack there in the upper left corner of this graphic, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. They are commonly referred to as the books of Moses or the books of the law or the Torah, which simply means law. And they came to be known as the Pentateuch, which means five-volume books. So this is a five-part series. It's a cohesive unit, a single cohesive narrative that is told in these first five books. And, of course, due to its placement here at the beginning of the canon, the beginning of the Bible, it is of particular significance for us to make sure that we have a good handle on what God is doing. In Genesis, we noted that God created all that we see, and He created all of it to be good. It was not lacking in any way. He made every provision for the creation to flourish. We, of course, learned about humanity and God's design for humanity and the unique place in which humanity was given within the creation, again, as image bearers of God, with somber responsibility to represent Him in His world. We also noted how humanity rebelled and sinned, and destruction and death entered into the world. And even there in Genesis, in that first book, we also noted how God put in place a rescue plan, a plan to restore all of humanity into a right relationship with Him. That plan, of course, centered on a man named Abraham. God chose Abraham out from among the nations of the world. Abraham was from an idol-worshipping family. He wasn't necessarily a perfect man by any means, but God chose him and determined to enter into a covenant relationship with Abraham and his descendants, and through them to bring blessing to the entire world, to all the nations of the world. And we saw how God protected and preserved them through a lot of unique circumstances. And we ended there at the end of Genesis with Joseph, who was Abraham's grandson, great-grandson. And Joseph came into Egypt through a rather circuitous fashion. It's hard to kind of see what was going on there. It seemed rather bad, but God used that experience to position Joseph in Egypt. He came to be second in command to Pharaoh. He won great favor in Pharaoh's eyes. And the end result of all that was that All of Joseph's countrymen, all the descendants of Abraham, were brought into Egypt and preserved during a time of widespread famine. So we've seen God's goodness, His initial plan to redeem humanity, and we've seen how that started to unfold. So we end here with Joseph in Egypt, and Exodus picks back up where Genesis left off. We have Joseph now having died, and there's a coffin in Egypt. Joseph, this tremendously significant figure, godly man, who directed the nation to God, is now gone. And so there's a major transitional moment. What will happen to God's people? What will happen to His rescue plan, to God's rescue plan? So let's pick up here in Exodus 1, verse 1. Provides the context for us. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. So we see God's continued blessing on Abraham's descendants, on the people of Israel. Exodus means exit or departure, and the book is well named. It speaks here of God bringing his people out of Egypt. So they exit Egypt. We're going to be talking a little bit about all that was involved in that, but this is really the primary redemptive event in Israel's history, the Exodus, as God brings them out of Egypt with a strong, powerful arm. And the Exodus is repeatedly put forward as the template for all of God's redemptive work. So the New Testament writers, writing to the church, continue to reference the Exodus and these themes. And so I'm suggesting to you that this describes Israel's salvation and ours. We learn something about the nature of God's salvation. We are not primarily Jewish, ethnically Jewish people. God is doing something particular with the Jewish people, and we are part of God's redeemed people through Christ, the church. But we see something here in the redemption of Israel that is very instructive to us, and reveals to us God's MO, how God operates in terms of salvation and redemption. So we're going to trace through Israel's redemption, and we're going to learn about our own redemption. The first thing I want us to notice is the need for salvation or redemption. While the descendants of Abraham were preserved from famine, they soon found themselves in a pickle, a significant dilemma here in Egypt. We pick it up here in verse 8 of Exodus chapter 1. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. So again, Joseph had he had the favor of the Pharaoh. But that Pharaoh was gone, and Joseph was gone, and a new king rises who has no particular vested interest in Israel. All he sees is the latest census figures that the people of Israel are multiplying at a much greater rate than the people of Egypt. And if this trend continues, we're going to find ourselves in trouble. And so he took drastic action. He subjugated the Jewish people. He made them his slaves, and he put them to work building his pyramids and other structures in some of his key cities throughout Egypt. And of course, we know that this was just the tip of the iceberg, right, for Israel. The other thing that the king did, that the Pharaoh did, was to put in place population control measures to cap the Jewish population. And he gave specific orders that all male children born to the Hebrew women were to be thrown into the Nile River. So this horrific scene here of children being not just aborted before they're born, but even after birth here are being killed under the orders of the king. I mean, this is a desperate, unthinkable, unbearable situation that Israel found themselves in. It's here that we're introduced to one of the main characters in the book, that is Moses. So Exodus chapter 2. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." Can you imagine the plight of Moses' mother, concealing the child from the Egyptian authorities until she knew she could conceal him no longer, and placing him, her child, in a basket and putting it out into the Nile River? I mean, can you even imagine? I don't know. We might read into the text here, read between the lines, to think that there was a little bit of a plan in place. She perhaps knew that Pharaoh's daughter and some of the other Egyptian women would maybe catch sight of this basket. We don't know. That's pure speculation. But to let your child go in a basket out in the river just reflects the horrible situation that the people of Israel were in. Moses was raised in Pharaoh's palace, given every conceivable advantage, wealth, fame, power, education, influence. But Moses knew that he was not an Egyptian. He knew that he was a Hebrew, part of the descendants of Abraham. We're actually told that Moses was nursed in God's providence, right, by his own biological mother. And in that culture, in both Egyptian culture and Jewish culture, it would not be unusual for a mom to nurse her baby up to 5 or 6 years of age. So you can bet that Moses' mother took full advantage of those 3, 4, 5 years that she had to convey a sense of identity and to convey the faith of their people. By the way, parents, don't underestimate what can be conveyed to your children before 5 years of age. You can convey a lot to them after 5 years of age, too. Don't get me wrong. But I think sometimes, especially when they're young and we're having to repeat lessons again and we're not sure that anything's really getting through and there's discipline involved, and we can sometimes lose sight of the tremendous influence that takes place. And Moses' mother, you know, clearly was part of the equation here in instilling a faith in Moses and a sense of identity. At the age of 40, Moses had an encounter that altered the course of his life. Let's pick up here in verse 11 of chapter 2. "One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And the next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, 'Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?' The man said, 'Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?' Then Moses was afraid and thought, 'What I did must have become known.' When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well." So he has a midlife crisis, right? He's 40 years of age. Something's stirring in his heart to go out and see how his countrymen are doing. Again, he has a sense of identity. He knows that he is a Hebrew. And he sees this unthinkable scene that not only grieves him, but makes him really angry. He sees an Egyptian mercilessly beating one of his countrymen. And he makes a calculated decision. It wasn't simply a rash act. Notice he looks this way and that. It wasn't just in a moment of rage he struck out. He considers the situation. He looks around and he kills that Egyptian, buried him in the sand. Hebrews 11 actually tells us what Moses was thinking in that moment. Here it is. "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated. He made a choice to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater worth, as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. So Moses kind of weighed the situation, and he made a conscious choice to side with the Hebrew slaves. Just think about that. Putting everything, all the advantages and wealth and influence of Egypt, and chose to side with the Hebrew slaves. He knew the promises that had been extended, right? The covenant promises that had been extended to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and to Joseph and to the people of Israel, that he would make of them a great nation, that he would bring them out of here, that he would establish them in a land of their own, that he would make them a source of blessing for the nations of the world. And Moses said, I'm going to hitch my wagon there. By the way, be careful where you hitch your wagon. Don't trade eternal joy and reward for a cheap thrill, for a momentary burst of pleasure, for an easy path. Moses here is so instructive in how he takes the long-term perspective as he considered his allegiances. We might start to look at Moses as the hero of the story, but we would be wrong. Notice here that his initial brave attempt to deliver the people failed. He kills the Egyptian. I think in some sense, Moses must have thought that this was going to win the trust of the people. Maybe the people would rise up. Who knows what Moses was thinking in this moment, how the plan was going to unfold. But I have to think he was a little surprised when he's talking to a few of his countrymen the next day, and they want nothing to do with Moses. Moses viewed himself as part of them, but they did not view him as part of them. Right? They weren't going to let this rich boy from the palace come in and tell them what to do. So in the wake of all this, Moses flees Egypt and finds himself living as a shepherd in the fields of Midian. So that was his attempt. In the prime of life, he had a certain bravado about him, and it comes to nothing, right? He's unable to do anything to resolve the situation for his people. He can only run. This is what I want you to notice here in this opening section is the helpless condition of the people. It's summarized in chapter 2, right at the end of the chapter there, verse 23. During that long period, the king of Egypt died, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. They had come to the end of their own resources. The only thing they could do was cry out to God. This is not an account of a resilient people characterized by ingenuity and courage. This is not an account of Moses and his tremendous leadership skills. This is an account of God's great power to deliver a helpless people. And we see this over and over again in Scripture. This is the recipe for those who would want to be saved, to experience salvation, to come to the end of themselves. And Nicodemus, the wise rabbi of Israel, was told he had to be born again. He had to start over. The rich young ruler had to humble himself, put aside any sense of pride and self-sufficiency. Jesus said, anyone who doesn't receive the kingdom of God like a child will never enter it. Unless you come humbly, you'll never get in. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit, or the beggarly in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is not attained or conquered by human works or merit or effort. It is a gift to be received by God's grace. So here in The salvation of the people of Israel, we get a glimpse of what is required for anyone who would experience God's salvation, to put down their pride, to recognize their sin, to come humbly before the Lord, to receive His good gifts. The need for salvation here is so instructive. Well, 40 years go by. God appears to Moses in the wilderness in a burning bush. God identifies Himself and says, I'm going to send you back into Egypt, Moses, to deliver my people. Moses is now 80, and all of the bravado is gone. Now in chapter 4, we have a whole chapter dedicated to Moses' whining. It's all about, I can't do this, I'm not a good public speaker, the people aren't going to listen to me, we've already tried that, they don't want to listen to me, can't you send someone else? On and on and on until God gets angry and says, you're going. And in His grace, He sends Aaron, Moses' older brother, to go with him. He does something interesting. He says to Moses, what's that in your hand? It's the great question there in that chapter. What is in your hand? And Moses says, a staff. It's a simple shepherd's tool. But in God's hands, it would be used to do great wonders, right? God would use that simple piece of wood, that stick, to demonstrate all sorts of wonders to Pharaoh and to Egypt. You see, God delights in using the foolish things of the world, like shepherd's staffs, to confound the wise, the weak things of the world to confound the strong. He's chosen to place the glorious message of the gospel of His grace in jars of clay to show that the power belongs to God and not to us. Remember the scene from Indiana Jones? We don't often quote him for theology. But the Holy Grail, and everyone's having to determine which of these cups, all of these chalices, which one is the Holy Grail. And people are pulling out the gold ones and all the rubies, and oh, this is the glorious one. And finally, Indiana Jones grabs the little wooden mug, right, and said, this is the cup of a carpenter. And at least in that instance, I think Indiana Jones got it right, right? He saw something there in the way that God works, to use simple things, to use weak things to accomplish His purposes. Don't use your weaknesses or your disabilities as an excuse. They might be the very things that God wants to use. Those might be the things that qualify you for serving God in a unique way. Moses was not some superhero. He seemed to have some speech impediment. He was not very high in self-confidence. He didn't have any particular skills perfect for what God wanted to accomplish. So we see a great demonstration again. But all of this flows out of a spirit of brokenness. The need for salvation here is something that is certainly instructive for us. There's also the means of salvation, how it was carried out, beginning here in chapter 7 and continuing on up through chapter 15. Moses and Aaron returned to Egypt. They stood before Pharaoh. They gave God's message, let my people go. And of course, it didn't seem to work very well, did it? Pharaoh did not respond. He hardened his heart. And so God sent a series of devastating plagues on Egypt. What were some of them? Talk to me this morning. Flies. I might be able to profile people based on the ones that stand out to them. Yeah, that's interesting. Flies everywhere. Yeah. Frogs. Even in their beds. The text is very specific. That would not fly at my house, let me just say. We'd have major issues. Okay. Good. What else? Boils. Painful boils. Yeah. Blood, water to blood, so the water of the Nile River, the water that you had gathered for your meal that night, it all turned to blood. Darkness, 3 days of intense darkness. Good. Hail, yes, that damaged the crops. Good. So, all of these things, I had certain kids kept yelling out even after we were done. We didn't cover all nine, and they were kind of concerned about that in the 9:30 service. But, yeah, all these things, we could go on, right? And in the midst of all of it, Pharaoh didn't budge. So it seems that God's plan is not working, right? This is not having the effect that it was supposed to have on Pharaoh. But then we get a little look behind the curtain here in Exodus chapter 11. God had already told Moses before he ever went to Egypt, Pharaoh's not going to listen to you. Okay, this was recorded back in chapter 7. But notice what we have here in Exodus 11, verses 9 and 10. The Lord had said to Moses, Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in Egypt. Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go out of his country. So we're actually told, the very first statement about Pharaoh was not that Pharaoh hardened his own heart, but that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. That raises some theological tensions, doesn't it? How we sort through that. Paul actually tries to address that in the book of Romans. It's part of the mystery of God's sovereignty. But God, in some sense, hardened Pharaoh's heart. He wanted Pharaoh to resist so that he could do more miracles, so that he could do more displays of his glory. It wasn't enough that he performed one powerful plague. He wanted to perform 10. He wanted to make his glory known. And so every time that Pharaoh tried to resist God and counter God, he only contributed to God's glory. There's a wonderful little peek behind the scenes here as to how God was committed to setting this thing up in such a way that his power and his glory would be undeniable. Pharaoh played right into God's hand. It was a divine setup. And by the way, this will preach in our day. Don't miss this. God is sovereign over human authorities, even ungodly ones. I mean, don't panic, my friends. Whatever your political persuasion, okay, God is not unsettled. God directs the hearts of kings, even ungodly ones, like water, and he directs it where he wants it to go, according to the Proverbs. We can grieve over sin. We ought to grieve over sin, but we ought not to be panicked or unsettled. We ought to have a keen sense here of God's sovereignty, even over human leaders. God would send one final plague, and this time Pharaoh would let them go. God was going to take the life of every firstborn son, from the firstborn of the lowest slave to the firstborn of Pharaoh himself. We get a glimpse of this in Exodus 12, verse 21. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood in the basin, and put some of the blood on the top and on both sides of the door frame. None of you shall go out of the door of your house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the top and sides of the door frame and will pass over that doorway, and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your houses and strike you down. Obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants. When you enter into the land that the Lord will give you as he promised, observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, 'What does this ceremony mean to you?' then tell them, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the house of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians.' Then the people bowed down and worshiped." So the people of Israel were not going to be immune from this final plague. The other plagues only affected the Egyptians and not the people of Israel. But this plague was going to affect the whole land. But God gave them a way in which the people of Israel could avoid God's judgment. They were to kill a lamb, each family to kill a lamb, to take the blood, put it over the doorpost. And when the Lord came in judgment, and his angel came over the land of Egypt, he would spare the people of Israel, those who had the blood on the doorpost. In the middle of that night, after losing his firstborn son, Pharaoh begged Moses and the Hebrews to leave the land. And they didn't just leave with their lives. God instructed the people of Egypt to give them their valuables. And in this way, Israel plundered the Egyptians. A tremendous, unthinkable reversal took place as they left Pharaoh's presence. Of course, there's one final chapter. They weren't quite out of the woods because they left, and God curiously led them right there to the edge of the Red Sea. Not a very good strategic decision, not a good military decision, because Pharaoh, of course, decided to pursue them. His grief for his son turned into anger, and he realized he was losing all of his slave labor. And so he gathers all of his armies and horses and chariots and sets off in pursuit of this ragged bunch of Hebrew slaves. And he has them right where he wants them, hemmed in at the Red Sea. But once again, it's all a setup, isn't it? God opens the sea, delivers the people through, and when Pharaoh and his armies try to follow, God closes the waters and destroys his entire army. Once again, Pharaoh's pride only contributed to God's glory. The powerless Hebrews stood there on the shore of the sea and sang of their great God. This is the point I want you to catch here. There was no confusion about who brought them out of Egypt. It wasn't by their own strength. They were hopelessly in bondage and slavery. There was no question about who brought them, gave them victory over Pharaoh's army. Right? It was God and God alone. And God always acts in a way that leaves no room for pride and self-promotion. The same is true of our salvation. It is a miracle, completely of God's doing. We recited it in the creed that Craig led us in this morning. It's nothing we contribute to our salvation. It is entirely of God and His grace. We are deserving of judgment. It is only because He has chosen to deliver us. So we have the need for salvation, the means of salvation through God's unmistakable power. We have the purpose of salvation. In chapters 15 through 35, God did not save his people or free them so that they could do whatever they wanted. God instructed Pharaoh, "Let my people go so that they may worship me." That was the end game. That's what God was freeing them to do, to serve Him. We see it played out so clearly. God's purposes were to advance His own glory and His fame among the nations. It just is repeated. It's just a sampling. "I will take you as my own people and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." "Tomorrow," Pharaoh said. Moses replied, "It will be as you say, so that you may know there is no one like the Lord our God." Moses replied, "When I have gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands in prayer to the Lord. The thunder will stop, and there will be no more hail, so you may know that the earth is the Lord's. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, but I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." Repeatedly, God's purpose was to advance His fame. Salvation, we have a nasty habit of making our salvation about us. And it's not about us. It's about God, and it's about His glory, and it's about His purposes. And we are reminded here that God has a purpose in saving us. After leaving Egypt and crossing the Red Sea, this is actually, God declares this to the people, His intent for them. He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, a distinct people in the world, my lighthouse to the nations." This was God's purpose for them. And of course, He took them there to Mount Sinai, where He gave them the Ten Commandments, His moral standards for how they were to live. But beyond that, He gave a bunch of other instructions too, like what to do when you come across your enemy and his animal is fallen down under the weight of his load, and how you're to help your enemy. That's strange. People don't do that, but God's people should. And he talks about Sabbath guidelines. They're to rest one day in seven. It was a key part of their testimony, a key part of what made them distinct in the world. They were commanded to feast. God gave them like these seasons. I don't want you to work for a week, and I want you to eat copious amounts of food. He wanted his people to be characterized by joy and hope, and this was a key part of their identity. So it's not just that God wants us to be morally distinct. He wants us to be distinct in our attitudes and in our worldview and in our orientation. This is God's purpose for Israel. It's God's purpose for Israel, and it's God's purpose for us. Not just that we're saved and we go to heaven when we die. God desires us to be his distinct people in the world. And finally, the blessing of salvation. These last chapters, 35 to 40, talk about the tabernacle. God was going to, he gave them instructions, very specific instructions for the dimensions of this tent and the various pieces of furniture that would go in the tent. This was to be a place where God would presence himself among the people, where the people could encounter God. And then in that final section in chapter 40, God's glory fills the temple such that Moses can't even go in it anymore. This powerful presence of God right there in the center of his people. And we reflected on this last week that Adam and Eve, when they sinned, they were expelled from the garden, expelled from the presence of God, expelled from the tree of life. And the longing was to get back to God, to get back into that place of fullness and human flourishing. And here we catch a glimpse of it in Exodus chapter 40. God redeems his people. He lets them know how he wants them to live, and he establishes his presence with them, and they experience his protection and his guidance and his blessing. It's a wonderful glimpse. It doesn't last long, but it's a wonderful glimpse of what we all long for. And it's really the outcome of our salvation. Several little gospel glimpses. You don't need me to unpack them for you. Jesus is the Passover lamb. Craig already referenced this as part of our worship. He was killed so that we might live. Jesus is the manna sent from God to sustain us in the wilderness. Glossed over it, but God provided for their needs, sending the manna each day. And very explicitly, Jesus is the manna sent down from heaven to sustain his people. Jesus is the living water that quenches our true thirst. God brought water out of the rock for Moses and the people of Israel here in Exodus. And God is that true living water. And Jesus is the true tabernacle where humanity encounters God. Very interesting phrase in John 1 where it says that Jesus, he dwelt among us. Literally, he pitched his tent among us, which is the word for tabernacle. He set up his tabernacle right there. A wonderful statement about Jesus as the place where humanity encounters God.